So I'll tell you, kind of, once you've detected gravitational waves, kind of very jump on how you extract the information from them, quickly for compact binaries, and quickly talk about telling the final state, mostly finding black holes, and constraining properties of things that look like black holes early on, if you actually have them, on the signals you actually see in LIGO. So kind of motivation, you have LIGO detecting all these things, so you like overview of all the signals have been announced so far, showing you the two black holes, giving you the median masses and the median mass of the final black hole. So here's first detection, and then they're going in chronological order later. And so you see we have small holes, big black holes in the mass, and also, of course, the Bernoulli's law you've heard about. So we'll talk a little about both of these. And the other motivation is, of course, that we've seen all of these already with just the two LIGO instruments, and then Virgo helped out with the latest black holes, which introduced, of course, the planet tensor. We also have more detectors like the Kago detector being constructed in the Kamiokuma mine in Japan, and then LIGO India, you see, is just a place to feel. We haven't been posted yet, but the second detector used to be at Hanford, the optics are on storage, and they'll go to India once they've constructed all the beam tube and vacuum assembly and everything.
Sorry, is that right? Do they have now the full land purchase and everything?
I think that the actual final bits of all the little pieces of land may still be being worked out, but they've gotten, I think, all the government land has been acquired, and I think a bit of the private land has also been acquired.
So there is something on the ground already?
Yeah, there is stuff on the ground. This is from the LIGO India Twitter feed.
Yeah, it's not just a photo of something.
No. They actually, I mean, if you see Tao and Sue and Dave Saints, he has like all these stuff with the Laiuko doing the land acquisitions, and they've gotten big chunks of it yet. I think there are still little pieces that are being worked out, but I think most of it's there. I don't think they've like instructed anything besides these posts, though. And just because, in case you're wondering, this GEO-600 is the much shorter, so it's only 600 meter. Detector in Hanford, mostly technology development, but in case you know, something is very, very close by and fairly high frequency, you would see it there as well. So, I mean, once you see have all these tuning, you'll get much more time up, so the duty cycle of the entire setup will increase, and you'll also get better scholar collation. I mean, just looking at binary black holes, so this is even just at the first building run, and this is showing you. As you could segment filling run, which we've already finished. So then I'm telling you analyze the third filling run, which I'm starting next year. That we have some probability for seeing more than 10 black holes, 135, 170, so that easily tens of black holes you expect to see in the third filling run, which is after that year. And as you go even along with the design sensitivity, so you're going from here to the filling run will be about this curve, design sensitivity, you get even more. Basically, you expect to see lots of things, particularly lots of black holes, you know, more binary neutron stars. We have also a black hole neutron star system. Who knows what else we'll see? And I know the continuous wave group is very helpful, so other people are kind of skeptical they actually will see anything. But really, just even the compact binary cosmos, what can we expect to challenge our charge space and atomic physics? So I'll just give a few examples. There's lots more than we'll talk about. So, first, an overview of kind of basically what you can expect to obtain, very roughly, and kind of since you need, you have a signal, some good model for a waveform in order to extract the physics from it, kind of what this current state of waveform modeling is. Then the first application I'll discuss is when you have one of these binary black hole signals, how to determine the final mass and spins. I was showing you, I just did the final masses, but you also get the final spin as well. Then also make two asides, so if you go sort of backwards, you won't know if you have a processing system what the spin tilts were at formation, so how much the spins were misaligned to the orbital angular momentum, how can you infer this, and what you can do with a minor neutron star, at least what we're able to do so far. And then I'll talk quickly if you have things that are not black holes, they can do look like black holes, how close to black holes do you have to be, and finally I'll conclude. So, if you actually want to have the information you obtain from compact binaries, the first thing you do is you do federation theory around that space, which is what's in the approximation. But then, of course, you have to go into numerical simulations eventually. But regardless, you can, with, you have a Cobain range, you have the 9 spin parameters, the 2 masses, 2 times 3 spin moments, or 6 spin moments, 1 vector for each pole, and 1 eccentricity. Only saying the eccentricity is negligible in most cases, unless you happen to own the black hole and dynamically very close to the merger. Simply speaking, you have another parameter that tells you if you start at some time with the limitation of ionization in its orbit, but you don't need to worry about it.
Warm temperature separation.
Yeah, so in this is saying if you want to describe the entire history, if you want to start with initial conditions, then yes, you need to specify some initial frequency. This is more, this is you can observe infinity, so it's gain rate on the separation. But if you just want to say this is a binary coalescence, it started very far as part, and then it came clearly, you don't need to specify separation. Of course, it is a band at some point, and you this is in the figure out frequency at that point. So, well, space containing matter, for like a neutron star, as well as solid objects, you have many more energy than binary black holes, formerly really infinitely many, of course, as we've had continuum fluid. So even in the N-spiral, where you can look at things in the containing picture, you'll have molecular moments binary due to their spin-induced information, tidal information, as well as this standard time tidal heating, and of course, these are just down the tidal stuck to the object. Of course, in reality, you don't have to look at the entire series. It's only you'll look at the first leading several multipoles in the electric theory, and people have shown that you have these quasi-universal relations that relate, say, spin-induced multipoles to tidally-induced multipoles. And of course, once you get the merger, then you have to deal with all the full microphysics. So we actually won't deal with this much here. But this is something to worry about. When you have the sensitivity, it's not even fine, it's very high frequency, and you don't have the sensitivity to see this with the current detectors. So if you want to model all the waveforms, so simply for binary black holes, you can have a silent identification on a computer, and then in principle, you just go through the parameter space. In practice, you cannot do this because these things are very expensive, so you have to have something to interpolate in them, and you try to include as much information from perturbation theory, that's turning into black hole perturbation the way that you can. So, in fact, if you have searches, you can pick binary templates to actually just post come to the data and look at things. You're actually going into the format that can find the parameters, you usually do static sampling to find which waveform template fits best. So, if you're looking at the dominant quantum hole mode for binary black holes and quantum hole orbits for line spins, this is kind of the simplest case which detect most of the signals. We'll see, waveform models are pretty well developed. So you have the effect of one body, things are natively time domain. We're actually mapping the right problem to an effect of one body problem, and then you have some high order things you take care of with information, then calibrating the numerical activity. Then there's non-logical ones where we say, well, we're just going to do something like that. I highly say you make a crayon drawing the waveform, but you basically look at the waveform in the frequency domain and see that you have some parts type of Pygmalion, the end part size of the black hole perturbation theory, and in between you can fit the high order terms waveforms. So the state of the art version of these models have names, which you see in LIGO papers sometimes, names, and they'll be used for a lot of LIGO data. You can't use these time domain waveforms in most data models because they're just too slow. You're just solving analytical equations, so you actually have to go to the frequency domain and use these reduced order models, which Michael Brewer dropped on directly go through these. If you want more than just the dominant mode, you'll be working on this as well. And I'll put first, just you have to worry about precession. And then here there are also models. So again, both the one body and phenomenological models. Here, the phenomenological model one that's used most because it's quite fast. The EUV model is very slow. You'll only use it for 2914 and 2704, and both because they're high mass black holes. So in upper time bands, you can actually do this. Pay painfully, you can do it. They're working on optimizing this, but they have not yet been able to make a reduced order model of the system. So if you want higher modes, this is something you'll start on. You'll start to apply these to LIGO data, but not in the post analysis yet. Similarly, eccentricity is something you'll start on. Again, not something you'll be using LIGO data analysis yet, but should be happening soon. For matter effects, the first analysis on 2708-17 used just the Pertutonian waveforms, that's using perturbation theory. But then it was checked with these phenomenological, phenomenological additions. And I'm like, oh, wavelengths, we have to just take some known and calculus in Newtonian theory and then fit for phenomenological high order terms by calculating numerical ability, wavelengths of finite Newton size. And then you use the final black hole wavelength as well as by the particle. Obviously, that's fitting for that. The effect of one body models include tidal deformations as well, but these are, again, not being used for anything that's been published yet. Okay, now we had kind of an overview of what you have, the techniques to look at these models exactly. Once you've seen one, how do you infer the final Lefmann spin? Of course, these wavelength models actually have the final Lefmann spin in them, but not always in the most successful way, or necessarily using the best fits available, because then you just calibrate out with your higher order terms some of the other things. So we've gone back and done from the beginning, but let's also show you over here, basically, the sets of basically around the four, the we've seen, so they're actually all pretty much by the board as far as the spin goes. And it's when the equal mass constant your final spin. The mass, of course, depends on the tail mass. The binary most strongly, so it rates strongly, and then the two other things which we have not made a lot of those reviews yet, so I have to put them on by hand, so there's one, two, three, and three. The thing to note is that these actually are the black holes with the best determined and best spins we know of, so even compared to things that we are much closer by, like Sagittarius A star, which has F accuracy one out of 5 to 10%, which is, these are constants smaller than that in the best cases. So how do we determine these? So the only thing you would do if you wanted to say, well, do it in the most model-independent way. Also, it's just assuming GR is that you say, well, let's look at the quasi-normal modes. Well, even for the lattice finite black holes, if you follow the first one, you're only able to say that it's consistent with what you expect. This was done with the testing GR over here. So you see, here's the normal frequency and k time, and then you have the expected one from the final companion for the n spiral, in ways we'll talk about later, and then you plot various kind of what you cut, waveform, what you expect. You see that it's all consistent once you start cutting too early, but it's just very much larger. So for other things like LISA, it's a very nice thing to do, even for like I think that was good, well. But for us, we have to do something else. So what we do is we take the fact that you have, in addition to just fitting for the waveform itself, you can fit for the initial state to final state mapping from the final like all simulations, and here you basically put them back in spins, and it's all turned with all that momentum and mapping them into the final black hole. And so the first detector is used is just the Stone's log hour, which only used the components along the spins along the momentum. These are the ones that do the dynamics the strongest, and so they are ones that you can use the best, but they also neglect, say, if you have something that is just a big black hole, which has a spin in the orbital plane, then it's really get the black hole spiral spin wrong, because if it's big, then there's not much can do from here. So there's the theory to do more, and I'll show you how we do this, at least for the final spin. For the final mass, it turns out that just using the spins on the momentum is completely the good with the accuracy of penalty. As things get better with the detector, then we'll need to get better with the analysis as well.
So your last statement there, does it apply to the events that we have today? Or is that a general statement for the current accuracy?
Yeah, I mean, it applies to events we have today. We see something really, really close by, obviously, right, then you need to do better. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is basically, I should say, the current accuracy is our detector events. So people have done lots of things. So the thing fits the field used currently are one by the UIB group. I update the Helix of Lago one by Lisa and one of Tesla's final spin by Alan Blatt and Ritzel. So this last one includes the contribution in spin as part of fit, though we can bring up the same method I'll describe to augment the other ones. The other ones, you can actually take these aligned spin fits and add in the in-plane fins simply, and it definitely does quite well. So first, showing you how well the fits agree, we're here just showing you the radiated energy, so all that interpolation to boundless, which for chaotic convention is poison is obtained from the horizon mass of the final black hole, and versus the spin at an equal mass, equal one. Okay, you see this degree very well, the two bits that give you the mass of URB and RT. Same thing for the final spin in the same equal mass equivalent in case that they all agree as well. And then just to show you, you zoom in, and you can see some differences you get towards my method still very small, sorry, high spin. Yeah. Hmm?
For the only events, black hole mergers, the effective spin parameter, chi, zero or negative?
No.
So either small spins are misaligned. So here you assume that the spins are aligned.
So this is just for the purposes of illustration, it's how well it fits you. So I'll show you in general how to try the agreement in these simple cases. So in the dual case, analysis uses full misaligned spins.
Perhaps the predictions of the spin, final spin, if the spin is a seriously misaligned with respect to the orbital plane.
So I'll show you some later. I will note that it's not true that all of the events have effective spins because it's 0. 15, 12, 26 has.
Zero.
Yeah, but it's.
Yeah, there's one.
There's one.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So, again, looking at the final angular momentum, you see that here you have to get the turnover, they still agree. Well. And the case where they don't agree well at all is if you actually really crank up the spins a lot and they put equal maximal aligned spin on both of them and then have obviously symmetric mass ratio, just reduced mass over total mass. There's from this equal mass, this is stream ratio, and this is from the URB grid one, so this is showing you that you have interesting behavior in some of these fits, and some of them also go slightly extremal. The reason that you have all these differences here is that there are very few new explanations in this issue, so it's not easy to tune them, but the UAV field that they've managed to extrapolate fairly well.
Sorry, you're saying that off-minded out goes out one and some?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you go to the previous, there was something that went too fast for me. So it's equal mass, equal line speed. And that's a final dimensional momentum scale for orbital mass. I'm confused. So why do you have only 0.8 when the other graph is 0.98?
Oh yeah, I missed.
If I go from this graph, I said the largest parameter is 0.75 something.
Yeah.
While in the other one you show 0.90 something. So what's the difference?
So this is that the final angular momentum scaled by the total mass, not the final mass.
Oh, the total mass, there's only initial mass.
Yeah.
Why do I care about this?
This was just to show that you actually don't, it's not monotonic. It's not monotonically increasing that.
It's not what, sorry?
It's not monotonically increasing.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was?
Yes. The final spin continues to increase monotonically as you go to equal mass is equal line spins, whereas the final momentum doesn't. Do scale by the initial bound. Anyway, what do we do to take line spin fits and turn them into ones where they account for the in-plane spins? Well, the simplest thing you might think of doing is just adding them in quadrature, and indeed this works at will. You just take the thing you get from the aligned bit, the fringe of the small skin, add in the implant spin bits, and then scale it. And it turns out that in the initial mass is better than the final mass. This is something that Sasha Usa noticed. It actually looks quite well, as I'll show you. So the other thing you do is instead of just taking the in-plane spins calculated at wherever your starting waveform from, so usually when you're doing the analysis of LIGO, you pick some initial frequency, often the low frequency in band, like say 20 hertz, but it doesn't have to be, and you basically parameterize the waveform by these spin tilts there. So basically you then take these, use positron expressions, and evolve them forward to the SQL frequency. It doesn't really matter where you get to, as long as you're in somewhere in that thing, that improves the wind. In fact, there's even just comparing in oscillations with relatively short, roughly looking at, say, 2120 hertz for the small mass body, then you have only a velocity of only 0.07c, so you expect this to be much more helpful there. As mentioned previously, for the final mass, it turns out you just need to use the aligned spin components along the online momentum. It doesn't really matter even if you hold the spins or not, but the online spin makes a little bit difference, but not a lot.
So what you're saying is this is the final speed projected along the orbital angular momentum?
Oh, what is? So this is the final spin. If you take the just the components of the spins projected along the angular momentum, which if you look at in our simulations, does pretty much give you, if you take the post-Newtonian in orbital angular momentum and project the final spin along it, this agrees pretty closely with that.
Sure, but here I have I'm trying to understand the left.
Okay.
Yeah. Left hand side is a projection.
Yeah, the left hand side is the full magnitude of the dimensionless angular
momentum. The magnitude, it still doesn't tell me the direction.
That's right. So this, you'll have not been so interested in the direction. I can't think of any particular reason to.
What I'm not understanding is how it's going to come in. You're augmenting something. You're now accounting for the fact that the magnitude can be larger due to the contribution on the planet.
Yes, so that's coming from here.
But how does it come in the waveform? In the waveform model, you have the directional dependency. So how are you going to? So you have now improved a little bit the magnitude, but there is a direction also that comes in the waveform.
Yeah, this is just taking the parameterization waveform that you have in terms of the initial masses and spins, and then going from there. I think that in principle, if you wanted to, you could take out the direction as well. You know the direction of the orbital angular momentum of the binary from the waveform as well, but...
Now, what I'm trying to ask is, does this really improve the template?
No, we're not improving the templates.
Oh, I see.
We have processing templates already, and this is just using this information to improve the calculation of the final spin.
Okay. But this is something that is, unless you have the individual spins, this is something that you wouldn't have access to in the waveform.
No, the waveform is parameterized in terms of the individual spin.
It's not an observer. It's not something that can reach us through an observer.
Well, you can by looking at the ring down itself, obviously, but you don't read this off directly from the waveform because you don't parameterize it in terms of these quantities. I think I'm not understanding your question.
Answer, keep going.
So if you then compare, so this is just showing you the improvement you get in comparing with all the aligned spins using the fit with the augmentation. So this is showing you the histograms of the error compared to a whole suite of in-house simulations from a few of them, both functional code and spectral code and SXS, and that is kind of like a table document. So then the number ones are processing simulations, of which we have 180, and the blue ones are the lines. So the blue ones we went well, but you can get up to 100% errors in the final processing simulations. You don't include the implant spins you would expect. And if you then include these, then you get errors. They're still, in some cases, up to 20%, but much better. This is, if you then even try adding these in some obvious way to the LIGO data, you find they make no contribution to the error bar you have. It's statistical. Then if you compare what happens when you use spin evolution down here without spin evolution up here. You see that for the final spin over here, this then shrinks things a bit more. So the RMSA over the entire lichen from 6 e to minus 3 to 5 and 5 e to minus 3. Again, as I said, you expect larger improvements when you have to look at all your data because it's much longer signals for low masses. And then if you then do the other thing that's done in LIGO, which is to try to reduce systematically the bits themselves by averaging over the ones you have. So you then do really better still. So for the masses, it doesn't really matter much. For the spins, you go from a mass of 5.5 in 3 to 4.9 in 3. So as I said, usually physical errors are really larger than systematic bits, but we expect that, for instance, you see something like 23914 again, done some city, for an SNR of about 70, probably is probably around 1%. So the modeling needs to improve as well. So any questions before we go on to some slides? Okay. So I said that instead of going forwards to the final spin, you can also ask, well, if you want to know something about how this conformed, I think, how do you go backwards? So, for instance, if you have something here, you have some misalignment due to a supernova kick and you get some precession then, you want to know actually what the tilt was back when it formed, not close to merger. So you take the same thing you're using to evolve forward towards the merger, then you find this is computationally much too expensive to use. You're using standard orbit average protein equations to use over 10 thousands of samples to get from parameter estimation. Whereas you can use this prison average evolution from Hess and Carissa et al., and you can do these evolutions fairly efficiently. So this basically lets you evolve of the total angular momentum as a function of the orbital momentum, and then you can real tilt into the. So I was going to put an expression that decided against it because it's a bit technical. So what I've done is implemented a scheduling method for solving these equations due to Katarina Tatuano and collaborators, which use elliptic functions. And I had to regularize it because it has the problems numerically with catch-up cancellation. If you're too close to equal mass, then you get actually the same like a data, and also so that you can linearize the equation, and even when you're far away and write an error bound, let you know when I have to do that. So Carter Gupta has been collaborating on a lot of this, including the current implementation of the previous work in the automatic post-processing LIGO, has been working with me to test, like, if you want to evolve backwards, you don't want to start with just the you have curly, they're probably a bit too close for the precession average evolution to be accurate. So you evolve out with orbit average evolution to some point in order to make this as short as possible because it's expensive, and you use precession average evolution to go the best way. Unfortunately, she's found in corners of the space where there's still some check the code, they're not being passed, so I have to go back and check the numerics again. So the other thing to think about is, so I should tell you what to do with finding black holes, find the state. Now, also sleep by the neutron stars, what do you do there? So, of course, there you have much, much complicated physics, it's not the standard equations, but you can at least say something, as I'll show you, even if you don't actually know that whether you formed a neutron star black hole. You're pretty sure that you formed a black hole because this is the standard way of getting the gamma burst, even if you steer off axis, it was probably a standard gamma burst. This is the thing I've heard from people who know about these things, but. But even if it wasn't, we have seen the ratio is robust. There are also things that people have been looking at with the peak luminosity energy merger, but they were unable to get a fit for the total energy in terms of, say, the solar parameters and tidal. And this is really important because you end up waiting most of the energy from a hypermassive neutron star doing that part, the evolution. So, what we decided, this is in collaboration with John Veach and David Keitel, is to just give a little bound of radiated energy the predicted in the absorbed waveform. So the best way of doing this, some kind of a really theoretic, that's the way to take these unknown waveform reconstruction, these wavelets, so you know, from base wavelets like this, but these only reconstruct up to 300 Hz, and you the template analysis needs to accumulate as an RBM. So this is a nice picture showing you just the final 10 seconds, right? 20 seconds, 30 seconds of the waveform, because this spectral beam, so it goes up about 30 hertz, up to even you squint, or you can think about going to 500 hertz. And then you want to, again, like, put as much energy as this as possible.
Sorry, why do you say that's the most direct way? Why can I not just use PN or based on?
Well, I'm saying most direct, it's always, if you're thinking of an observation, you see something, you try to reconstruct it without any sort of a priori knowledge of what it was.
Okay, you're going to use Wavelength because that way we can do better than that.
With what?
Well, we use resummation.
No, I mean, but resummation proposes you have some theory. This is purely a data analysis statement. You have some time series in your data. You want to know how, what the best representation of this is.
Okay, so without using any assumption.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to say, well, if we show this a binary Hadron solve, then there's obviously there's a poor way of doing it. But if you want to say, well, this is something we really want to be as honest as possible about what it is, then this is it. We didn't have it have been used, though. So you can then use the Donner-Codipolar template waveforms from the radiant energy. This is what you actually imagine is there. At 600 hertz, you actually see the template waveform is still accumulating in some SNR on the order of 1, and you're still reducing the radiant energy most of the miles bucks, I'll show you. This is what gave you the core bound of 0.025 solar masses, the way it's radiated. So if this was indeed a binary Hadron solve, then you expect to definitely radiate a few higher, probably because the tidal bounds play a soft wave of state, so they get close together and radiate more energy. But this is a yellow bound in case, you know, really something more exotic. So here's just picking some binary Hadron solve relations, the hybrids based on UB plus Inhai with BAM, made by Ritika Dutti, and Yana, and this is showing you that if you just go up to 100 hertz, so this is for a soft wave state, specific wave state, then we're matching in the hybrid on this UB, you know, template, which is what was used with the Inhai title. Thing, which doesn't affect the amplitude to infer as a check on the ALF2 ones. And then you have a superclinical state, you differ a little bit because you merge sooner, but still, well, then go further, you see that the template will resonate things drastically because you've merged by then, but you still are either radiating quite a more energy ahead here. So note that these are going to a higher scale. And here you radiate less energy because they are stiffer, they merge sooner, but even still, it's more than it. And just a little bit down here. So that's all for the things we've definitely been doing on legacy analysis so far. So here's now some things we have to do in the future, which is described in this treatment. And so this is basically if you have things that are not with binary black holes, they're making the signal. Do you think of finding black holes? How close do black holes they have to be? This is vibrations with your USB Rajiv's group and Kermit's Rajiv's group of PISA and Salvo MIT. So, reminder there are various theoretical proposals for such objects. You could have some things that are massive compact, material objects, and have no horizon, but look, kind of like black holes, you squint a bit. So they'll have generally material effects that I talked about really, because they look at non-turbotile probabilities. Other people look at the spin-induced formalities, and we'll, of course, include this as well as we go on. So a few things that you'll think about is for these things. So of course, proton stars, we have a massive probably self-attractive, you want to make them compact, still a field. Dark matter stars would be still a field, could be some more general. You want to kind of be very wild and construct things that directly have a good action principle. The in gravastars, but these are interesting because they have a deciduous interior, transitional matter, and they have negative tidal vulnerabilities, but the other things have, like neutron stars, positive tidal vulnerabilities. So how do you go from kind of view to a signal to how do you make constraints on like America to have binary these making signals? So ideally you'd like to make a waveform model kind of like you do for neutron stars, but there's both on such a license, which are the most straightforward, just like directly are still kind of not quite advanced enough. And we also would like to have an analysis that isn't tied to a spook model as possible, just because most likely if you see something that's definitely not a black hole, it's probably not something thought of before, probably. So kind of as a first general step, we use spook fluid stars to project in a state. This gives you some freedom and we have. It's only a two-parameter family, so it's fairly simple. And you know, to model things with positive tidal vulnerabilities. So then we give the standard tidal little terms. There's one in this position, so relative to the zero, let's say in tidal little terms. So it's at 6 p.m. relative to the dominant quadrupolar term, using the turning calculation binds slang and hindrance. So this is the maybe phase spectrum in the frequency domain. We add these to a frequency domain binding back home model. We use this model because it's fast to work with. And quite accurate. So the thing to make sure is that you don't use this model where the stars have already merged if they are definitely fairly puffy and not compact like a black hole. So we'll describe how we do this.
So, so you're doing stars, so why call them black hole mimickers?
So I mean, if you have a star that's, I mean, this is a star in the sense of a fluid. All by not starting the sun in its light necessarily.
Yeah, but I mean, the polytrope is not so much different from the neutron star. So, I mean,
no.
So I'm still not seeing the link with the black hole. It's not going to look like a black hole because it's going to be so much bigger than a black hole for the same mass.
So it definitely turns out that they can be reasonably close to a black hole, and you're allowed to have the data to have them based on just injections. We don't, they have to be fairly puffy, so you don't have to have them be really close to a black hole. Or to,
so are you considering stars that are more compact than canonical neutron stars?
Yes.
Like, what's the highest compaction?
So this is the next slide. So you can actually get, we didn't go to the lower values of the polytropy index, but you can get back to the 0.32. So in this, I guess, there are neutron star models that go to this. Let's come back. This is, yes?
What stops a star from collapsing to a black hole for the mimickers? What's stopping
it? Just pressure.
Pressure.
Stable.
Stable star. Mm-hmm. Take the 0.32. It's pointing that because lambda is so small, the tidal effects are going to be tiny. It's for long-term purposes, for a while, it's going to look just like the giant black hole.
Static
stellar collapse.
You need some neutral
deterrence
gas.
Right, but this is these polytropes can get to compactions of 0.32. So 1/3 and overall.
There must be some point where the star keeps collapsing.
No, this is stable.
I mean, there is a maximum mass for all of these. Like, maybe that's your point. But if you push, but you can, of course, tune the vast scale with tuning K. So,
but that's, if the two of these merge, then I mean, there is no guarantee that you won't form a black hole. I mean, there would be a maximum mass.
No, but you can do kind of a spirit. So just have these two merge with low mass. But then this year, you're in the mimicking, so you're going crazy. So you can then say arbitrarily just scale the mass. And so you can have 2 30 sort of mass objects. Which of course are ruled out by causality, but you're going to keep insisting on using that waveform model to go and see if LIGO can tell them apart from Mario Kart codes.
Kind of stuff.
Okay, let me rephrase my question. You have assumed indeed this pressure equation statement. What's the mechanism that produces the pressure?
So, I mean,
physically?
I'm completely agnostic about this. If you want to say boson star, then you actually have a the Lagrangian you can write down, say, a self-inductive
force or something.
Yeah.
I think you're overinterpreting what he's doing. It's just a mathematical model. He doesn't care about.
Well, I know he's into mathematics, I know the physics.
No. He's interested. LIGO goes and searches and tells you we've seen these objects. So it's a valid question, so to what extent can you really say the objects you think you've gotten really are those? So if you go to the analysis, at least pre-merger with the C max of 1/3, maybe the analysis doesn't tell you anything as far as, oh, they're different from black holes. So that's kind of the going up.
Yeah, this is not designed to say, well, I have some idea of what makes these things up. It's basically, I see something in the data, I want to know if I can mimic it with something that's not a black hole.
The gravity stuff, a zero model, you assume quantum physics comes in, some phase decisions, and that starts.
I mean, this is designed to be, I mean, this will not model gravitons because it doesn't give you negative tidal probabilities, but this is designed to be something that's observationally you can tell if you see something that's not a black hole. I don't want to worry about what actually makes it up. If I see something that's not a black hole, then I worry about this. Yeah, otherwise, I am happy to not worry about it. So, and if we have this logical state, K parameter sets the mass scale in, at least that's some minimum tidal probability you have. So this is showing you that if you increase in, you decrease the compactness and increase the minimum tidal probability. So if you have an upper bound on tidal probability from your analysis, then you can constrain in and a lower bound on the maximum mass, just from the lower bound the more mass of the two stars, assuming they're both. With our black hole mimickers constrains this thing. So obviously if you do this for both stars, then you overdetermine, so we let K vary for the two stars. You don't assume that the exact equipment is, so what you describe is polytropic.
Sorry, so if you have the collision of these, I don't know, very compact stars, two of these very compact stars, like what can you say about the merger renown stuff, like, I mean, this lambda, let's say, this lambda for this this very compact size, extremely small, but maybe the Majorana waveform.
I'm assuming that if you have things that actually look like stars that are just very compact, it will be like if you have direct collapse to a black hole in binary nodal simulations, where it actually looks fairly similar to a binary black hole merger. But if it's something more exotic, then we're talking about it for lunch, it could be something else. At the moment, we just stick with the Innspiral signal, well, because we don't have a good model for the merger ring down part.
So how would you determine that something's a black hole mimicker as opposed to a neutron star, just as a polytropic equation state?
So, I mean, if you're looking at low mass things, then this is not something we've considered. We're actually considering things that are the high mass things we've seen currently, where you no, of course, you can't have neutron stars that are so massive. But if you do see this, then and the thing I've seen, the AI groups at Senegal suggested that you can actually, if you have several of them, you assume they're all in the same family, then you can actually plot, say, the tidal probability versus mass, and then you'll see that if it's, say, a boson star, then these follow a much different and than the standard neutron stars. So this is one way of telling them apart. I don't think that you'll have thought exactly how sensitive this is to assumptions you make, but this is kind of a naive way of doing things. So just wondering whether these polytropic stars are really good models for things that like boson stars. So this is some calculating from Vitor Cardoso, all showing you the polypolar and octopolar tidal probabilities versus the maximum mass of the solar curves. I'll give you a free field boson star, something with a non-zero quarter coupling and a larger Fredon function quarter coupling, and then the dash curves give you. Okay, I think I've lost my this like 1.8 n equals 1.8 equals 1.3 the polytropes. So here you see that at least these compact ones seem to follow the polytopic thing state fairly well, whereas the less compact free field ones live in there, not to put the maximum mass a bit more.
So, sorry, where is showing here?
So this is the solid curves are calculations of the Bresenzer pedophore abilities, so protopolar and octopolar, versus mass scale by maximum mass of that particular model, and then the dash curves are this same curves for polytropic equation state. So E equals 1.8 up here and 1.3 down here. So I'm showing you that, I mean, they don't agree exactly, but at least it's only for this case, which a larger the coupling, which you need to have a more compact saw, they agree reasonably well with the polytropic curves. So now how do we decide where to cut off the analysis? So if we're using linear tile computations, we want to cut off the likelihood integral when we're doing the analysis to find the parameter system at low enough frequency that the objects won't be out of contact. Here's a reminder what happens with planet and stars. They have equal mass, they all have a contact like this is. Their unequal mass is the less massive and larger one. It's tidally distorted by the more massive of one. So you also want to account for tidal disruptions, so you don't want them to be too tidally uniform. So I'll just for simplicity, we've got both in the contact. And it's not just them touching, also one of them is being very, very stretched out, so we don't trust linear tiles anymore. So we test, and we do the analysis, and we don't know a priori anything about the system. You choose some masses, some sort of other frequencies, up to here, 1.2 times the inverse scale study over things, the injection, just because we know we put in, just to have a scale of things. We actually do the analysis on real data, and then we take the masses inferred from a full planet black hole analysis signal, and then we choose the largest cutoff frequency, such that some fact in 90% of samples, all that have tidal uniformity or the minimum amount of the equator state, have a contact frequency above the cutoff frequency. To do kind of illustrate this, so here's the 5914 case. So here we have a lot of curves in the M1 and lambda 1 on planes of the mass and tidal uniformity of the more massive object, and cutoff frequencies from 0.8 times the frequency of 1.2. And here you see this largest one, not quite the largest one, this 0.8 one, and then this one actually has 97% of samples having this criterion. Go to the next one, you actually only get 22, goes down even further, you actually get the minus one, it actually goes up slightly, but still not, it's only about 50%. We ended up using this lowest frequency to do the analysis.
Sorry, this is not based on, what is this thing? Is this a prediction or based on real data, or what is it?
So this is, we have done an injection of a binary black hole waveform into simulated noise, and then we recover using the waveform I described previously with the tidal terms added to a binary black hole waveform, and then we recover with these range of cutoff frequencies from, we have a low, we're doing this in the O3 like sensitivity, so lower frequency of 15 hertz, then 49 hertz, all the way up to 74 hertz, the other frequency cutoffs. And then we see which one of these is allowed by us saying that we trust the waveform model in this. It turned out that it ended up being.
I don't understand what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to say it again. So you use, you inject with a binary black hole waveform,
mm-hmm.
and then you try to get it with a tidal waveform.
Yes.
And then you're allowing something. So just the cutoff frequency to which you're going to allow yourself to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if I lower the frequency at which I have the maximum cutoff,
yes.
I will have arbitrarily good agreement, right? Because earlier on,
no.
Any earlier on internal effects would not play a role. So I will have perfectly good agreement, right? The further apart they are, the better.
No, you'll just have. No. you'll just end up allowing more and more freedom in the parameters you can map the signal with. Because you'll have less and less signal noise ratio, and if you just have a short signal, you can match this with any parameters.
Sure, the SNR will change, but what is it? I mean, but just to say, the earlier I introduce my cutoff, the better the two waveforms are going to be agreeing with each other. The volume of the SNR, how much signal you're building up with the detector, okay, that's a separate thing. But I don't know what you're saying here, because I mean, at some point, what are you maximizing, the overlap?
Yeah, it's the standard thing where you use the matched filter overlap to construct the likelihood.
And you want to use that to say to what frequency I will keep gaining SNR?
No. So you could have used that criterion. The things we wanted to use the fact that we actually have is parameters that we, for the tidal forms of these in masses, that we expect to have the contact frequency of the two stars above the maximum frequency we use. So basically, if we use too low frequency, we don't really say anything because we allow really, really massive stars, which are, sorry, really, really puffy stars, which could have come to contact before then.
I don't understand what is the criteria. So you're trying to... Yeah, maybe you can repeat it or write it, because I don't understand.
So I read it down here. So it is a...
What is the ISCO that you're using?
So this was just as picked. This is, we will just pick... We actually do the analysis on something where you don't know the answer. You'll presumably pick the masses, the total mass you get for the inbound measure ring down and set a scale, but really you just need to have some scale at which you carry the...
Sure, sure. How are you defining that ISCO? What's the definition of that F ISCO?
So here, this was given from the one from the ejected masses. It said, just to set the scale. So you need some way to size...
I understand, but how do you define it?
What I told you. It is the... The stable circles of it correspond to the total mass of the injected parameters. This has nothing to do with the analysis except to set the scale at which you choose the upper frequency of the cutoffs.
The ISCO frequency of Schwarzschild Blackwell or rotating Blackwell? I mean, that
changes the... Yeah, it's a Schwarzschild Blackwell, the standard one. This is just to set a scale. I mean, we don't have to use the fact that it is the ISCO frequency anywhere except to say that here's a reasonable set of cutoff frequencies, and then once we have the cutoff frequencies, we forget everything about the fact that it's obtained in this way. So in principle, you don't even need to use this data to reduce the number of frequencies you consider.
So let me just explain it. If I understand it, you're predicting how well you could constrain by this lambda and mass for these mimickers, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
You're not actually constraining, but this is how this can be constrained using current LIGO.
So this would be actually for the upcoming...
For upcoming LIGO, this is how it can be constrained.
Yes.
And, right, I mean, that's a reasonable thing, I mean, yeah.
But, well, I still don't understand what you're doing. So there's a scale, but now you're gonna try to get a sense of at what point can you trust your template?
Yes.
Yeah, what is the question? How do you answer that question?
This is it. With this contact frequency, which also you have, you calculate data. So you have some, once you have the mass and time vulnerabilities, if you assume one of these pod traffic in the state, then this tells you how big the stars are and how tidal vulnerable they are. And then you can say from a positionian calculation in the what point would they come into contact or become two tidals or two dust? And we check that this actually reproduces things you get with neutron simulations fairly well.
That's related. I'm not
good. So are you assuming independent tidal lambda for these two objects?
Yes.
Okay. But you know that they must be related if you assume they're the same type of object.
Yes, but I don't think you have enough information and we're not assuming that we have the same equation of state for both objects because we don't have the exact model for the equation of state. So I think if you assume that they are Related, I think you assume too much with some analysis. It's possible there's a way to do it. It would be great if there was, but I don't know of one.
Well, if you assume they have the same type of inference, they even use the mass of a different, then you still have this kind of rough relations.
Yeah, but I mean, if you want to sample in the equation of state, I guess you can do this, but this is... Maybe this is something to consider. I have not. Let's try this.
So, when you say cut off frequency, you just take the binary black hole template and you cut off.
Yeah, you cut off the likelihood integral.
Cut off the likelihood
integral. So, I mean, you're doing an integral in the frequency domain over the template and the waveform weighted by the
and
noise.
You ignore all the frequencies above the cutoff.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
So anyway, I want to estimate the contact frequency. So the kind of naive thing to do is just to take all the separation equal to some of the bodies of radii. Isn't that even in Newtonian, it's not quite right because the tile will be deformed. So you can do things that Yalek has worked on, like this one, and really Landry, do the superficial or sometimes shape numbers to determine how well the so it's deformed, and this is kind of done first by Edmond Nagel. I think it roughly suggested to them. And they use the very clean order of things, quadrupolar thing, where it tends to higher multiples and use known Hornpian corrections, not yet the thing that Yalek and Edmond have recently calculated for the second moment, as well as Sal, Kiron, Vickens, and mass frequency relation. When we found that using things under multiples of 5 gives really accurate results. So what it looks like is you have Newtonian in the picture, a induced this tidal field, radius the star, between these superficial numbers, and then you be round by these stars radius deformed, and you end up getting an implicit equation, so this gives you this kind of relation. You have a quadrupolar convolution with some Hornpian corrections, and then higher time type instant here, and the radius, and the whole thing with the method switch. And then you take this and you put it into a standard Postinian thing to result a post-point particle part of Postinian, giving you the radius in terms of contact frequency into x, and then you have also the contributions from the tidal log number. So the best thing to do would be actually just check is whether this actually next, the waveforms agree sufficiently well. We've not done this yet. We have compared with calculations in two polytropic Bayesian simulations, the dimensionless contact frequency, and our comparisons agree actually much, much better than I expected to when I first did this. So, of course, these contact frequencies in simulations are quite subtly really depend on which isodensity contour you use, and usually if you go to higher resolution, they get to high frequencies. But we decided to stick with this question, which doesn't include some coordinate translation to go to higher frequencies because it's more conservative. So if you do projections, we saw this project a while ago, so we have just like the first 4 events. So we use no three like sensitivity, so there's this late high noise curve from the Bernstein's document.
So, can I ask something? So, what you say, I'm a little bit puzzled by this. So, you're saying you just cut your likelihood.
Yeah.
So, you just ignore all the frequencies above something. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the information is there in LIGO, I mean, of future raptor version. It's not that they just, you lose the information, you just don't know what the model is there, right?
Yes.
But so that's just kind of another variable that's not quite statistically sound that you ignore data based on the model, which is a little bit funny. I mean, usually you have, the way that it's usually done is that you have a parameterized model,
mm-hmm.
you change the parameter, and then you see how well it fits the data. That's how the likelihood works. But then you're actually just cut your likelihood, this is like throwing out data based on your model. And that's not usually a good idea. That's just based on
Yeah, I also have worried about this, but I have not come up with a better way of doing it.
Right.
I'm also not an expert on statistics.
Well, I mean, in principle, you could take your two polytropes and do a numerical simulation all through the merger, and you would find that, well, the Inspire will match up to a certain frequency, then the ring down would be completely different. And that would give you further, you know, a further handle to constrain the model. So it's...
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to assume that the actual things we're looking for are polytropes, so I'm...
No, but we know what at least we know some sample of what could be at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Another object.
No, this is the plan to actually compare the Weigel model to numerical simulations and see at what point do they start disagreeing substantially.
With everything's going after a complete waveform, so it's merger and the ring down, or whatever is the last piece. So we know what the last piece could be, I mean, at least a subset of what could be. Could be a black hole if it collapses promptly, which would have, perhaps, depending on the parameters, different physical parameters. Could be a binary structure that is going around, as we see with neutron stars, where we also can predict what that frequency would be. Or it could be something else that is oscillating at the fundamental frequencies of that something else. And for boson stars, we know what those are. So I can give you a model that has full Inspire merger waveform that accounts for all these things. And the early part is what you're doing. And then depending on the parameters of the objects that are coming and the kind of the compaction of these objects, you could have a final object if it's a black hole that differs strongly or in a very subtle manner with respect to the black hole. You could have at the end of the day if the objects that came were black holes.
I mean, but we don't have a completely parameterized model for any of these things. You do? So, you've got to tell me about this. There, going on with this. So, this is first just looking at the 2.3914 results. So, this is applying the detailed vulnerability for the polytropy index. So, what we have here is being part of into 5.2. This shows the upper bounds you get from the data. This is the lower limit on the you've also an index you have from the fact that you assume these state, and then you see that these can be produced by these electric indices, and the ones over here cannot be. So here we do the same plot, except we have all four events, and see that as you increase the mass, you get better states for the most part. Two, you're assuming the order of four and 2.3914, and state is a little. So this still shows the part that's constrained by the plot that we have this one here. But here we then show you the maximum mass. We also have that thing below, this curve again showing things from 2.3914, like one, are pulled out, and above this curve. So you increase the particle index, you actually also want to increase k to get suddenly large maximum masses. So then you constrain the minimum radii to 0.58 to 0.5 times the Schwarzschild radii. So this is coming from these ones, we actually are not pulling out the object model at all. And then these are minimum radii, and then constrain to 2.6 between 5 and the star Schwarzschild radii. And then the masses are constrained to be really close to maximum mass, 0.6.9 times maximum mass. Of course, all these fragments increase to increase. So, this is showing you the cutoff frequencies used. So, here the 0.8.9, here is all the full amount. And then, if you actually want to go and say, well, look at a particular presence of models, this is the fourth. Of bottle, and you see that all the things below here are rolled out by minimum and over there. You can also then go instead of 90% federal levels to the 95% level, you can actually have of say the least resistance to ocean L36 like one, which is then when you constraints on the with a mass. And something concentrated for comparisons is if you have a mass of interaction, is what you would get in this plot, and then you have the test, and it's this cross link in my results, is my justice potential, is just for comparison with these values. Then you have the map mass pulling out things below this curve, and then pulling out things below this curve. Things to do, there's the negative topology in case, application to the intersection by Legend Virgo, you get different schematics for the spin, and we'll include the magnetic teleformability because you pointed out that Yagi had no bottom, then larger than you expect. It only turns out this mostly cancels the 1.5 yen tail alternative. So, conclusions, there's information we extract on special wave observation C, and that's how you obtain final map and spin. All coefficients, they obtain low bound median energy and plans obtain low bound energy. Interesting things to think about for the future is, can you also obtain the kick velocity? Here, the precession, the physics is much more complicated, and you have a sensitive chance of the influence spins. But there's an interesting book with circuit models that might help solve the mapping problem there. And then also show how you can train bodies of black molecules that make them make kind of like a whole thing else we think we see, and kind of we probably would say that just from observation of the tiled formula, you convert those sum models and proton stars with observation of the Earth 3. Thank you.
Questions from the audience?
So I guess to go back to what Niash was saying, so I like the idea of trying to be completely agnostic about the nature of the object, but the price to pay seems to be high. The price to pay is to cut off the signal so that you don't have, you know, the merger and the ring down. And to have a model that would be successful at producing the in spiral and the merger and the ring down, I mean, that's a lot more demand on a mimicker than just producing part of the So given the high price, I would say maybe you should try to be so agnostic and be happy to adopt the boson star model
that
can be evolved through the process.
I think it's certainly something that we would like to do. Lewis seemed to think that there was a way of doing it currently. I'm not aware of this. I thought that the simulations would not quite advance to this. But.
The other editorial line I would take is, you know, gravistars should be boycotted. No one should, you know, ever, you know, refer to that paper, and, you know, let's bury them into the dustbin of science. I think people have been paying far too much attention to those stupid models. But that's, you know, that's my personal view.
As far as the fundamental physics thing, I don't know at all. I think it's phenomenal, it's interesting, but besides that, also.
For the questions, let's thank Nathan again.